Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
And now, the definition.
So with partnership, but with purpose, I pass this great gavel of our government. With resignation, but with resolve, I hereby end 40 years of democratic rule of this House. With faith and with friendship and the deepest respect, you are now my speaker, and let the great debate begin. I now have the high honor and distinct privilege to present to the House of Representatives our new speaker, the gentleman from Georgia, Newt Gingrich.
Let me say, first of all, that I am very deeply grateful to my good friend Dick Gephardt. I couldn't help but, on my side, maybe overreacted to your statement ending 40 years of democratic rule. That I couldn't help but look over at Bob Michael, who has often been up here and who knows that everything Dick said was true, that this is difficult and painful to lose, and on my side of the aisle, we have, for 20 elections, been on the losing side. And yet, there is something so wonderful about the process by which a free people decides things, that in my own case, I lost two elections, and with the good help of my friend Vic Fazio, came close to losing two others. And I'm sorry, guys, it just didn't quite work out. And yet I can tell you that every time when the polls closed and I waited for the votes to come in, I felt good, because win or lose, we've been part of this process. In a little while, I'm going to ask the Dean of the House, John Dingell, to swear me in, to insist on the bipartisan nature of the way in which we together work in this House. John's father was one of the great stalwarts of the New Deal, a man who, as an FDR Democrat, created modern America. And I think that John and his father represent a tradition that we all have to recognize and respect, and recognize that the America we are now going to try to lead grew from that tradition and is part of that great heritage. I also want to take just a moment to thank Speaker Foley, who was extraordinarily generous, both in his public utterances and everything that he and Mrs. Foley did to help Marianne and me and to help our staff make the transition. I think that he worked very hard to reestablish the dignity of the House, and I think that we can all be proud of the reputation that he takes and of the spirit with which he led the speakership. And our best wishes go to Speaker and Mrs. Foley. I also want to thank the various House officers who have been just extraordinary. And I want to say, for the public record, that faced with a result none of them wanted, in a situation I suspect none of them expected, that within 48 hours, every officer of this House reacted as a patriot, worked overtime, bent over backwards, and in every way helped us. And I am very grateful, and this House, I think, owes a debt of gratitude to every officer that the Democrats elected 2 years ago. Thank you. This is a historic moment. I was asked over and over, how did it feel? And the only word that comes close to adequate is overwhelming.
But I first want to suggest to you my personal belief that we are engaged in a great moral and practical effort, that we are committed to renewing American civilization. And I believe that's our battle cry, that we want to be the party and the movement that renews American civilization. And that renewing American civilization is both an idealistic cause and a practical cause at the same time. And the challenge to us, it seems to me, is how do we keep the magic for our children and for the world of what America has meant? How do we in our generation renew and revitalize this most remarkable, most unique nation, what Jefferson called the last best hope of mankind? I would argue that the simple fact is that we live in a time when the most practical is also the most idealistic. When the very changes you most want in your neighborhood, in your city, in your county, are also the changes we need for the whole country. And that in fact, we are at the end of an era, that the welfare state has failed, and that we are in the business of inventing a new era. That our movement in renewing American civilization is a movement to create a new time in America. And I have four propositions for you. First, there is an American civilization. And I think it's a very important concept. We are the successors to Western civilization. The Western civilization was European, it was Caucasian, it is a small semi-continent, it is backward-oriented, you have kings and dukes and princes, it has a class structure. But the American civilization is very different. But starting with Jamestown and then with the Pilgrims and the whole process of the rise of modern America, that American civilization is multi-ethnic, but it's not multicultural. We represent everybody in America who believes America is multi-ethnic. But as Theodore Roosevelt said, there are no hyphenated Americans. This is not a new debate. There are Americans of many descents. And that American civilization, because it is a civilization, has a very important set of rules and principles that have to be learned. Now, the second point I'd make you is what I call the four can'ts. I just use that as a way of remembering. But I think if you test out this paragraph or this long sentence, you will find that it is devastatingly effective and frighteningly true. It's very simple. You cannot maintain civilization with 12-year-olds having babies, 15-year-olds shooting each other, 17-year-olds dying of AIDS, and 18-year-olds getting a diploma they can't read. Now, my third proposition. Remember, one, we're an American civilization, and two, you can't maintain civilization when those things happen. My third proposition is the welfare state has failed. Now, Barry Goldwater took 40 minutes to explain that sentence. Ronald Reagan took about 20 minutes to explain that sentence. I simply say to folks, we're not going to debate this. Anyone in this room who does not think the welfare state has failed, go to any major city in America and watch the local television news for 3 nights. If that isn't the face of failure, write me a letter explaining what it would look like. So my fourth proposition. Therefore, we are in the business of replacing the welfare state, not repairing it. To renew American civilization, you must replace the welfare state. Now, it's very important for two very big reasons. The first is, if you think you're in the business of repairing something, you accept its current structure and say, all right, I'll stipulate it really ought to be sort of like this, but let me do two little things better. You know, a better New York City would have IBMs rather than the current card, the current paperwork, or it would have nicer people at the front desk. I'm saying the opposite. Erase your assumption of the current structure of the welfare state. Now let's build a new system. Let's replace that. Second, I'm asserting that the core values of the welfare state are wrong about the way human beings function. You cannot reduce a citizen to a client. Establish a set of rules that are anti-family, anti-work, anti-property, anti-acquiring, anti-opportunity, and subject a human being to the petty regulations and red tape of a petty bureaucrat without having tremendously destructive impact on that person. And I would argue that the pathologies we see in the inner city and the pathologies we see in West Virginia are in fact the direct result of the welfare state and not a sign that the welfare state hasn't quite done enough. We can't stand for it to do anymore. And therefore, we are now liberated from having to try to solve their problem on their terms in their system, and we're now going to come over here and we're going to build a replacement. But I want to tell you what I think is the most difficult moral burden that Republican leaders who've been around as I have to bear. There are only two sentences that define all of American political history since 1968. The first is that the Democratic Party went too far to the left under Johnson and McGovern and never came back. The second is that the Republican Party rejected the best efforts of the American people to make it a majority. For 25 years, the American people have been saying, we don't want the Democrats. Please grow up and accept being a majority. And for 25 years, we said, ha, you can't make us. We can't do much about the Democrats. They went too far to the left. They're still too far to the left. That's their problem. But we have a huge burden of responsibility to change our behavior so that everyone who wants to replace the welfare state and everyone who wants to renew American civilization has a home, and it's called being Republican. And we have to really learn how to bring them all in. There are much greater differences between us and the left than there are between anybody inside our coalition. But unless we actively, constantly remind ourselves of that, they will, both in the news media and in the Democratic Party, consciously find ways to force us to split. Because they know the only way they can maintain power from here on out is to block us from becoming a coherent majority. One of the great problems Republicans have is we don't realize how huge our potential majority is. We keep walking around as though we're the natural minority, when in fact we're the natural majority, but we can't get our act together. Let me give you some numbers. Taking just the left, the candidate of the left for president since 1968 has gotten the following percentages. This is an amazing set of numbers. In 1968, Hubert Humphrey got, rounding upward, 43%. It was, I think, 42.7. In 1972, George McGovern got 38%. In 1976, no one on the left could get the nomination. Jimmy Carter ran as a Southern Baptist populist anti-Washington reformer who was seen as socially to the right of Gerald Ford. So the left-wing candidate got zero. There wasn't anybody in the ballot. By 1980, we'd all figured that Jimmy Carter was A, confused, and B, liberal. He got 41%. In 1984, Walter Mondale stood proudly in San Francisco in a moment I'll never forget. I was out there as part of a truth squad. And he stood proudly and he said, I will raise your taxes. We closed down our office on the grounds that we did not want to slow down the rate at which he got to talk to the American people. The American people said, I think he really will. He got 41%. In 1988, Michael Dukakis did not use the word liberal until mid-October and was a new Democrat. This is a quadrennial process now. And all Democrats are new Democrats because they know what you'll do to old Democrats. And finally, in mid-October, he said, all right, I am a liberal. He was in Central Valley, California, when he finally said it. He got 46%. And we elected the first sitting vice president to win the presidency since Martin Van Buren in 1836. And in 1992, in a three-way race for president, the new version of I'm really not a Democrat said, I will cut middle class taxes, I will cut spending, I am for workfare, and he got 43% of the vote. And one of the reasons Bill Clinton is in desperate trouble is that he and his staff think they're Ronald Reagan in 1980, when in fact they're a minority candidate with a minority support representing a minority of the country. Now look at those numbers for a second. Notice how consistent they are. Between 38 at the bottom, 46 at the top, averaging around 42 or 43. And the only reason they are that high is that the Republican Party has failed to reach out to blacks and Hispanics who are extremely pro-family, extremely anti-gay in the military, very anti-tax increase, very pro-workfare, but who feel that on ethnic grounds, the Republican Party hasn't been open enough. And if we ever learn how to reach out to blacks and Hispanics, my guess is the left candidate of the left will drop to about 30%. And just literally, just plummet. The Washington Post poll said, do you think the president has cut spending enough? By 77-6, the country said no. 77% want deeper spending cuts. Second, USA Today. Do you think taxes are too high? 2%, two, said we're undertaxed. This was the Let's Contribute group. 55% said they were already overtaxed before the Clinton tax increases. And 41% said their taxes were about right without the Clinton tax increases. Now, if it's only 96% are either okay or too high, and only 2% think they're undertaxed, to come in with a $300 billion tax increase is an act of self-immolation. I mean, it is irrational. Third polling example. The Atlanta Constitution, in 10 states, asked Southern blacks, do you believe we should require work from people who get welfare, including women with young children, which is the hardest way you can ask the question? 82-11 in favor of a work requirement. Now, if 82% of Southern blacks favor a work requirement, I mean, the only two places in America that don't favor a work requirement are the Democrats in Congress and the Stanford faculty. The Washington Post, again, asked the question, do you think government should be bigger or smaller? Now, in 1984, at the peak of the Reagan Revolution, when Reagan was getting reelected in a landslide, the answer was 49 smaller, 43 bigger. That's a six-point plurality. This spring, the answer was 65 smaller, 30 bigger. So now let me rack the numbers up. 77 cut spending more. 96% were not undertaxed. 82% work requirement. 65% smaller government. You begin to see a potential majority here that's very big and very real. And if you can find a way in your district and in your campaign and in your constituency to find resonating comments and questions that begin to fit that two-thirds to four-fifths base, where people just go, oh yeah, of course that's right. The most popular single phrase, the 1992 campaign, actually uttered by George Bush. Government is too big and it spends too much. More people agreed with that sentence, strongly, emphatically agreed with, government is too big and it spends too much, than any other single sentence said by anybody in the 1992 campaign. They just didn't think the president had done enough to respond to that reality. And so 19% of them voted for Perot. And what I want to suggest to you is that there are three steps involved in being a citizen candidate, not one. When you go to see some kinds of consultants, they'll say to you, if I get you to win, who cares about the rest? You know, lie, smear, steal, what the heck, at least you won. Now, if you think about it, there is a corrosive cynicism to that attitude, which in the end, frankly, crippled George Bush, because he didn't keep his word. It is destroying, I think, Bill Clinton. And it's a very important concept. I want to argue that you have to win in a way which lets you govern so that people want to re-elect you because you actually did what you campaigned on. Now, this is a much harder test. And I'm being honest up front with you. This is not the easy way to do it. But for the country, it's the necessary way to do it. The three steps are, first, make clear what you believe and what you will do about what you believe. Second, wage a campaign that is clear about your commitments so people actually vote for the changes they want. And third, actually keep your campaign promises so people can help you get done what you and they want and what you and they have promised. We've got to go back and say, what are the key rules that we're going to teach so that everybody's able to be an American? And I want to suggest to you that there are five basic areas. I call them pillars. Think of it as the pillars that American civilization rests on. Five pillars of progress and freedom. And I think that freedom and progress are our two most powerful words. We are for freedom. We are for progress. That's how we measure things. You have more freedom. Have we made progress? Now, there are five of them. I'm going to just give them to you briefly, then I'm going to go through each one for a couple of minutes. First, personal strength. Now, I'll come back and define it in a second, but you can't have a free society without personal strength. You can't have a free market without personal strength. It's the most important single thing to teach the poor, because the poor need it more than the rich. Teddy Kennedy could hire a tutor. It takes personal strength to rise from poverty. Second, entrepreneurial free enterprise. Not just business, but the spirit of getting the job done. Whether it's a scientist in a government research lab, General Kenny, who I'll talk about in the Air Force, or somebody going out and Bill Gates creating Microsoft. The spirit of getting the job done, as opposed to the bureaucratic spirit of claiming the paperwork was processed. We failed, but at least we stamped the right documents. Third, the spirit of invention, of invention and discovery. What is it that makes America the most successful technological society in history? Fourth, quality as defined by Edwards Deming's profound knowledge. And fifth, the lessons of American history. What is it that is uniquely American that we should learn from when we try to solve problems? Now, I think these five pillars matter because I think if you master them and if you go back to your constituency and you look around your constituency, they will suddenly help you come up with creative problem solving in ways that are undreamable in the welfare state. The principle I want to give you is the Reagan principle of three. For your own campaign, when you win, for your own first year in office, listen to the people of your district. Listen to your campaign supporters. Listen to folks around you and pick three areas to focus on. And Reagan believed emphatically that you should always pick three areas and never more than three, because you had to focus. Now, if you remember, Clinton went out to see him right after the election, and Reagan told him to pick three. Clinton came back, he picked Zoe Baird, gays in the military, and raising taxes, which were not, that wasn't the list Reagan had in mind, but the principle's right. And so I want you to think about it, and let me tell you what I think. There are five quick characteristics. First, the ones you pick ought to be important to your majority. That is, the people you want to vote for you ought to say, hey, that matters. And this is, what I'm going to tell you sounds very obvious. You'd be astonished how many campaigns don't walk through this. First, they just have to be important to your majority. Second, they should affect daily life. Ideology's good. Problem solving's better. The theory of nutrition's good. Let's bake bread in the morning's better. So they ought to be areas that people could measure in their daily life. Third, they have to be doable. Everyone in your district would like the Fountain of Youth, and it would definitely affect their daily lives. I don't think you're going to get there. So they have to be things that you can, in fact, do. Fourth, you should, if you're given a choice, pick ones that unify your side, or at a minimum, don't split our side. That is, given a choice between one where you know you're going to be in a civil war with your own volunteers, and one where everybody agrees, pick the one you agree on. And again, I know this sounds obvious. Believe me, I have been in enough campaigns in my career. You'd be astonished at people's ability to slide into a civil war on their own side 6 weeks before an election. When all you got to do is say, let's not talk about that, let's talk about this. And you just come back to the ones you want to talk about. Lastly, in an ideal world, not necessary, but in an ideal world, it would be helpful. It's good if it's something that people do not yet, on the other side, know how to agree. In other words, when Bush picked the difference with Dukakis on taxes, it was one that Dukakis couldn't fight him on. I think it's a very important model that you want to pick ideally You'd like to pick topics where your opponent can't co-opt you. Now, you may not get there, and if, frankly, if you're first and you're creative and you do it right, it doesn't matter that much. But in an ideal model, you'll pick a topic which is important to the majority, affects their personal life, is doable, unifies your side, and by the way, your opponent can't be for it because his allies won't let him. At that moment, you have a huge winner. I want to talk about being a candidate in a campaign. I want to start by saying it's very important to think and act like a majority. If you walk into every door thinking, gee, I'll bet if they only knew what I stood for, they'd be with me, you have a very different psychology and mindset than if you walk in thinking, oh, gee, I'm probably in a minority. In addition, I think you want to psychologically move from being opposed to them towards what I've called a governing conservatism or towards creating a humanitarian Republican solution. That is, starting out with the idea that, and I believe this with the bottom of my heart, no child should be born without prenatal care. No young man should die in a firefight in one of our cities. No child should go through school for 12 years and not be able to read their diploma. And we have an obligation to find the system solutions that change those facts. And if you have the courage to walk up to every door and to say at every door, are you satisfied with the current system? If not, join us. Let's work together. I think you're going to be astonished the number of doors that have people behind there who say, yeah, I'm with you. This stuff's crazy. But they never thought a Republican would show up. Now, in that framework, I want to give you four terms that you can use as you design your own campaign. We actually invented this in 1983, and one of them you'll recognize immediately because it became very famous in politics, and that's the concept of a wedge issue. Now, we actually sat around a room one day and tried to invent, how do you think about designing a campaign? There are four words here, and I want to walk you through them. Wedge, magnet, shield, and turf. Okay? Now, a wedge is real obvious. A wedge issue is an issue which divides your opponent from the people. You know, it's an issue which allows tax increases. If you watch the Texas Senate race, it's a terrific wedge issue for Kay Bailey Hutchison to use on Kruger, because all she's got to do is go around the state and say, hey, I'm against the big tax increase. People go, yeah, I'm with you. Okay? Wedge issues are almost always anti-issues. This is what they're doing wrong. Just take most of the stuff Clinton lied about. Those are all wedge issues. Because he knew if he told the truth about him, he'd wedge himself away from the American people. Okay? Magnets are, here are the good ideas. This is what I will do that will make your life better. Now, there are two problems with magnet issues. One is it takes, I think, somewhere between 6 and 10 times as much effort to communicate a magnet as a wedge, because the news media can cover a wedge easier. So, and I can tell you this from personal experience. I can give one attack speech on Clinton, and I'll make 3 or 4 of the networks. I can give 70 positive speeches about health care and not make a single network. So it's much harder to get a magnet issue out. But in the long run, they're more powerful. Because in the long run, they bond you and your supporters. The genius of Franklin Roosevelt was he created for a generation a Democratic majority bound to him by Social Security, by the New Deal, by the Works Progress Administration, by all the different things he did. And so magnets are the creation of good things. I would argue that wedges were very important under Jimmy Carter and in the first half of Reagan. Wedges were vital to George Bush's 1988 election. He would not have won without them. But for us in the future, magnets are incredibly more important. The third is a shield issue. And a shield issue is just, you know your opponent's going to attack you as lacking compassion. You'd better find a good compassion issue where, you know, you show up in the local paper holding a baby in a neonatal center. And all you're trying to do is shield yourself from the inevitable attack. You're a woman, and you know they're going to attack you as being too soft for the job, and so you come out for a very tough crime position, and you're seen in front of the jail saying, let's be tough on criminals. It's very hard at that point for them to say you're soft. But the purpose of that issue is just to shield you. It's to stop their attack. The last is a turf issue. You drive Democrats nuts if you campaign on health, education, and the environment because they think they own that turf. So the simple act of being in the middle of it drives them crazy. And George Bush found that by running around and saying, I'll be the education president, He didn't have to convince anybody. It was just that the act of cluttering the Democrats confused them so much that just saying it drove them crazy. And so sometimes you just want to be in the middle of their turf to fight the war on their terms and to say to them, boy, I really do care about the environment. That's why when you voted to put that waste dump in our county, I thought you were being terrible. They go nuts because they're not used to the idea of a Republican suddenly competing with them on their own turf. So those are four concepts you ought to have in the back of your head as you start to design the campaign.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen. I am your brother, Vimer Deese. Welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. You were just treated to a portion from a Newt Gingrich training tape that he distributed all across the country as part of a strategy to divide communities against themselves. A patriot, if we could ever use the word positively, posted this video on YouTube some time ago, and I would have assumed that this video would have had millions of views. I assumed incorrectly. It barely has a couple of thousand. And actually, because I wasn't certain, I went and looked. And it doesn't even have 1,000 views. This tape, which is in the National Archives, is part of a series of tapes and a series of talks that Newt Gingrich gave around the country, paid for by big corporations and organizations that cater to big corporations, organizations that big corporations set up to spread the gospel of capitalism throughout the country. This tape and the other tapes surrounding it and the other material surrounding it is historically relevant. While the idea, or should I say ideas, that are innate to what we consider the cultural war are not new. They didn't develop in the 90s. They sure didn't develop in the 80s. These ideas had been around for hundreds of years prior in some cases, in most cases, just about all cases, but were at least 100 years old by the time they were taken and organized in the 60s, the 50s, the 30s, the 40s, and more recently the 70s and 80s. But not here to really talk to you 100% about their beliefs. I'm here to talk to you about the culture war. And to kind of shine a light on what it actually has produced. Now, understand, family. This culture war was necessary for capitalism to emerge, quote, victorious after the 1960s and 70s. Why? Because, see, the 1960s and 70s attempted to remind Americans what actually had, if we are going to use a phrase, made America close to being great. It wasn't capitalism. It wasn't the capitalists. It wasn't monopolies. I hate to acknowledge it because of all the problems that it caused. But it was a centralized government that was put in the hands of capable, responsible, visionary people. Sometimes politicians, sometimes institutionalists, sometimes bureaucrats. And what these people did was they looked at history and said, this works, this doesn't work. By the way, conservatives say they do that, by the way, but they don't. This works, this doesn't work. This is what we can do, this is what we can't do. This is what we need to build up to doing. This is what we've already been doing, and how can we make it better? That's what made America progress forward. What forced the federal government to take those stances? We're not liberals, being what liberals are, which are good lapdogs for the elite, was barely progressives, who in many instances were just disaffected liberals who were like, well, I don't really like socialism, I hate socialism, can't stand anarchism, the social workers kind of get on my nerves, but so don't the liberals, because the liberals aren't doing much of anything, so I'm here kind of in between the liberals and the radicals, and I'm saying we need to push a little bit harder, but not that hard. I get a lot of that energy from a lot of progressives today. It was mostly the radicals. Why? Because the real radicals, conservatives are not radicals, they're nihilists. They destroy for the benefit of destroying and, you know, using that for their, towards their own ends. They love to destroy. Radicals don't destroy like that. Nihilists do. Now, I want to just point out here that in my Funks in Wagnalls dictionary from like 1955, this is the definition of nihilism and hence a nihilist. A political doctrine holding that the existing structure of society should be destroyed. This is why I keep telling you they're nihilists. The radicals of the early 1900s, the late 1800s, had a vision for the world. And it harkened back in many instances to what had been dreamt about in Europe. A world where work took precedent over employment. Royal oligarchies were done away with. And depending on the group you talk to, there was some form of cooperative enterprise that would be engaged to meet the demands of the modern era. Now, in Europe, And it's funny because other places throughout the world, this was just natural, like breathing. But in Europe, the idea of cooperatives was constantly fought against by the royals because they understood the power of cooperatives. Now, they didn't call them cooperatives, but it was the idea that more than one person, a community or what have you, could own something that was valuable and that was productive for that community. They did not like that idea. We often do not learn about the history of economic theory in Europe. And there is a brother who died a couple of years back from, I think he was Chilean. He was an economist from Chile, if I remember correctly. Mansfield Maxneff, I think was his name. And he was the one who hit me about this idea. That back in the 50s, you could actually take a course called The History of Economic Theory. And what it did was it laid out for you the European historical record of all of these different competing economic theories. And the structures that went with them, why were they good, why were they bad, things like that. We don't talk about those things anymore. Back then, 100 years ago, they did. Because contrary to what the Iron Lady said, there is always, always an alternative. For those of you who do not know what I'm referencing, the Prime Minister of Britain, Margaret Thatcher, once said, there is no alternative. No, there is an alternative. There always is an alternative. The question is, can it be implemented? So anyway, the 60s and the 70s tried to remind Americans what had actually gotten the country back to the point where after World War II, the society could be built in a way that would be beneficial for the majority of Americans. Corporations, I've talked to you about this before, I might actually one day read this into this record. I might actually just read this into this record. That is the Powell Memo. Corporations saw the threat of this and started laying out ideas onto how to curtail what they saw as an anti-capitalistic fervor. A view, by the way, that they did not have mistaken. People saw the flaws in capitalism. And they saw the flaws in capitalism because, one, not only were they taught about it in school, but two, you have to remember, in the 60s and 70s, people who were teenagers had family members who were in World War I. Some of them, not all of them, but who were in World War I. You know, if you were a teenager, let's say you were 15 in 1975, and you had access to a great-grandparent, your great-grandparent would probably be in their 60s. Well, what does that mean? That means they were born in the 19-teens. They probably don't remember World War I, but I bet you this. They remember World War II, and they might have even served in World War II. I bet you they remember the strikes in the 1930s, in the 1920s. I bet you they remember the radical literature that went with those strikes. I bet you they also remember what the newspaper did to try and undercut those strikes. Now, I was under the belief for a long time that a lot of people did not pass this knowledge on, and some of that has been confirmed, but at the same time, that is a more contemporary problem. That has happened more so over the last 30, 40 years than it did in prior periods of time. People who are in their 60s and 70s, in the 70s and in the 60s, wanted nothing more than to share the wisdom that they had gained because they understood what capitalism was capable of. Seeing the reality of what these young people were seeing, the capitalist order struck back, and struck back good. Now, they didn't do it overnight. They had a 40-year period, or excuse me, not period, they had a 40-year plan. And it seems that that plan developed slowly and organically over the next 15 years. Now, when I say slowly and organically, I'm not saying that they weren't implementing stuff. I'm not saying that at all. No. What I'm saying to you is that they started planning, and then they took a look at the landscape, and as the landscape changed, they added another card to their plan. They added another page to their plan and said, okay, now we gotta work against this. We gotta work against that. We gotta work against... And they did this over the next 15 years, developing a hardcore strategy. And as they developed that strategy, they were implementing it. They were implementing it. How do I know that? Well, one, because Newt Gingrich, if you look through his background and you look at the individuals, the conservative organizations, the conservative people who were funding him and helping him spread his poison across the country, you'd see a lot of those people come up again and again and again and again in some of the institutions that were very active back in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. More, even if I want to take Newt out of it, and we'll be talking more about that clip that I played at the beginning of the show in a moment, even if I want to take him out of it, the publications of the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institution, all of it, oh, excuse me, and how can I even forget the Hoover Institution? All of it speaks to a dynamic planning brain trust that wasn't looking for easy answers and quick victories. They were looking for complexity and longevity. Even though most people, even though most people wouldn't know what was happening, they were wide-eyed and looking at everything that was going around, that was happening around them, should I say, and preparing themselves to take advantage of what they called opportunities when they arose. I believe one of the opportunities that they took advantage of was the rise of a person like Rush Limbaugh. Another one that I believe they took advantage of is the rise of Ronald Reagan in order to establish the DLC and thus push the Democratic Party, which they had been trying to do for over 10 years, push the Democratic Party towards the corporatist neoliberal stage. And they succeeded. There's a book there that somebody should be writing. And not in, unless it's an insider who really doesn't give a darn anymore, there's a book there. Ain't going to be 200 pages either. That's one of those that'll be 1,000 pages. Anyway, Newt Gingrich, I believe, is another one of those individuals who sold himself out. That ain't the word I want to use, but, you know. And they saw the potential in him and used him for what they could use him for. And they did use him. Now recognize this, family. Capitalism, in order to succeed, needs to tear apart communities. Hear what I just said. Capitalism, in order to succeed, needs to tear apart communities. Why? Because capitalism thrives, and this is the few times where you'll hear me use thrive, because thrive is not what most people think. I've looked it up. I know what the dictionary says. It says something about it being prosperous and blah, blah, blah. Well, if thrive was prosperous, then thrive wouldn't exist because prosperity already exists as a word. No. The chief word in thrive is rive, R-I-V-E. Most of you have never heard of it. Most of you have never used it. Do you know what it means? It has to do with tearing something apart. Research it. Capitalism thrives off of disunity. It thrives off of disunity. It is essentially, I call corporations cancers, but capitalism really is a virus that just hits a community, and the goal of capitalism is to tear apart that community, because once when it tears apart those social structures, then it can get in there and it can force the people living there to work for as little as possible and produce as much as possible. For this reason, GOPAC, which was Newt Gingrich's little political activity pack, GOPAC was right up capitalism's alley, because GOPAC produced a strategy which could be utilized to tear apart communities. And though it had been very active, in the late 80s and the early 90s, it took off in the mid-90s and the late 90s, even as Newt Gingrich's star faded. It took off then. It took off at a period of time. And don't look, understand, it's not just the tapes. There were people who were on radio stations, conservatives who were on radio stations, who were working from the playbook that Newt Gingrich laid out with those tapes. It took off at a period of time when neoliberalism and NAFTA was tearing apart the economic fabric of the communities. And right behind that came in this strategy to rip apart the social structure, the social structures and the social bounds that had existed within that community. So see, this is one of the few times when both sides really are to blame, but the one who did the most harm, the most harm that had the longest impact, well, hell, it was both sides too. I guess I can't say either one. But today we're talking GOPAC. Now, George W. Bush, being the president when September 11th happened, and then the strategy that he pursued after September 11th, almost inevitably played off of GOPAC's strategy. Us versus them kind of thing. And that enhanced the effects of the wedge issues. That enhanced the effects of the wedge issues. We are so used to GOPAC vocabulary that we don't even talk in terms of GOPAC vocabulary anymore. We take it for granted that these are real things that have always existed. And look, to some extent, wedge issues have always existed. But we take it for granted, should I say, that not only have these things always existed, but they've been as pervasive as this, when that is just not the case. How is it, and I've asked this question to conservatives of mine, how is it that LBJ had a landslide that Ronald Reagan mirrored less than 20 years later? One of them was like, oh, because, you know, people were fooled. No, people weren't fooled. No, people actually, once upon a time, they didn't have to say they were independent-minded. They just acted that way. They acted that way. Now, granted, black folks, we know what really happened in 1980, don't we? But some of those same people did vote for LBJ, so I'm going to give them, I'm going to, you know, hey, look, they swung heavy. Right? They swung heavy. And we know why. But today isn't that day. Today isn't that day. The fact is, because of GOPAC, because of that strategy that Newt rolled out in the 80s, a strategy that probably wasn't even necessary, to be honest with you, but it helped. We are the most divided that we've ever been. We can't even have a conversation about what is actually happening because as soon as we start to have a conversation, and this happened to me again last week, the person who's on the other side who proposes the topic that we should talk about suddenly starts moving the goalposts once when you start narrowing in on something that they don't want to acknowledge as being correct or true or right or against their philosophy. We are the most divided we've ever been because of that. And look, it's funny because if you look at detailed, you know, $100,000, $500,000 polls that corporations and other organizations commission, we are not that divided. On the issues, this country is a left, not leaning country. This is not a left-leaning country. No. This is a left country. But the division is so deep that people are divided internally. What they say doesn't match what they do. Now look, again, black folks, I've had conversations about some of this, right? About the idea of white folks being a little bit disassociative when it comes to their mouth and their feet. But today ain't that day. Today ain't that day. I get it. I understand. Today ain't that day. Stop yelling at your radio. So, you know, with this amount of division, and with Mr. Bush being a perfect marionette orchestrator of division, which, by the way, I still maintain, I think a lot of that came from Cheney. And I only think a lot of it came from Cheney because, as the one brother that I worked with told me who used to live in Texas, the governor is not as powerful as the lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor is actually where all the power rests in Texas. So think about that. And then think about the presidency of the United States under George W. Bush. George W. Bush was not the acting president. Cheney was. Not to give him a pass, but Cheney was. After Bush is done, though, you know, orchestrating all of those string pulls, which he finally started realizing the damage he was doing in about 2006, 2007, here comes Mr. Barack Obama. I'm going to please everybody, but only the people who I think matters. And I'm still going to try to be the unifier in chief. A man who clearly had not studied closely the situation in the country before he ascended to the presidency. And then came what I think and have always thought, especially since I discovered and watched this tape, was the perfect manifestation from the GOPAC strategy. Not only just the GOPAC strategy, but really the white mind in general. And that is one Donald J. Trump. I'm pretty confident I've mentioned it before, but I want to mention it here. From the standpoint of the white psyche, Donald Trump is a perfect manifestation of the white psyche in this country. He is braggadocious. His swagger is unwarranted. He is inconsistent with what he says, but he is shallow with every action he takes. He hates for the sake of hating. He is dismissive for the sake of being dismissive. He is cocky and arrogant for the sake of being cocky and arrogant. And believes greatness is his birthright at the expense of others. Even as he is presiding over the destruction, because of his ineptitude, of that thing which he claims to be great and claims to be his birthright for being great. He is a perfect manifestation of the white psyche, particularly since it left Europe and colonized the world. He also does not have any type of reference in his database, his mind, that is, for consequences. The only thing that he understands consequences as is something that is done negatively to him. Not something that is the result of actions that he conducted, that he committed, that he ordered, but something that is negatively done to him. And because of that, there is no lessons that are learned except for those that have to do with him gaining more and more and more power. Sound familiar? He is the perfect manifestation of the white psyche. He is racist. He is sexist. He is homophobic. But he appreciates homophobes who are on his side, or excuse me, not homophobes, but homosexuals who are on his side. And he really loves black folks who are on his side, and Asians and south of the border, non-white, what's often called Latina people. And Latino people. He sees the world in a very binary way. That us, them, 1-2, or I'm sorry, 1-0 type of, we call it an analog way of looking at things, but it's binary. It's, you know, nature has taught us a lot about the idea of binary concepts and the brilliance of binary, but he doesn't see that. He sees black-white. He doesn't see shades. Again, perfect representation, manifestation of the white psyche. This is actually what happens periodically for an organism. The organism will produce something that is a conglomerate of the state of that organism. If that organism is healthy, it produces something that magnifies that healthiness and improves upon it. If the organism is not healthy, it'll produce something that is not healthy and will often add to the problems which the organism is experiencing. If the organism is sick, because most people don't understand that sickness and unhealthiness is two different things, but if the organism is sick, the process of trying to eliminate that sickness does more damage because the body is not able to, maybe it doesn't do more damage, but it runs the body down, especially if the sickness is prolonged, because the resources that the body often checks on and pulls from to aid in the recovery after a sickness depletes. And sooner or later, the body will produce something that is harmful to it because of the depletion, especially if the depletion is not being repleted, if it's not being added to. This is why sometimes when a person is going through a very, very terrible sickness, they'll hit them with some, the medical community will hit them with some really hardcore antibodies to overwhelm whatever is happening and whoop, heal them right up. Heal them right up. Donald Trump is the regurgitative production from an unhealthy society. He is also a product and manifestation from GOPAC and from that strategy. And from the strategy that has been utilized since the 1960s to stop this country from moving in a direction that would heal it. Now, what am I talking about when I say that? Most people don't know this. But when you talk about political correctness, right? What you're actually talking about is the idea of correcting historical inaccuracies. That's what political correctness actually is. So I'll give you a great example of this. And it's funny because I actually found a book from the 1990s, and I apologize if my voice sounds a little bit off, which was deriding the idea of political correctness. And I wish I had kept the book. It frustrated me so much I didn't want it anywhere in my apartment. So I threw it out, literally threw it out. But it had a list of words and phrases that they split into two columns. The first one was the traditional usage of the word. The second one was the, quote, political correct usage of the word, or the replacement of the word. In many instances, it was swapping them out. It was swapping words out. So to give you an example, you often hear me reference Native Indigenous peoples. Yes, it's a mouthful, but it's actually correct. I often say Native Indigenous people in this country instead of Native Americans. Why do I not call them Native Americans? Because the politically correct way to say it is Native Indigenous people in this country. America did not exist prior to white people calling it that. Not only did America not exist, there's controversy about this. There was a tribe that had a name that was similar to America. It was either in what is present-day Canada or present-day Mexico. And there has been speculation, and I only heard this speculation a few years ago. I'm only repeating it because I heard it. That's where the name came from, is from this tribe. The name was similar to America, but it wasn't exactly America. I don't know. However, because there was such a systemic, organized, cultural attempt to erase the Native Indigenous identity, who they are, what their culture was, what their language was. Europeans did this. To reference them as the beholders of a continent named by those who attempted to destroy who they were, prior to those people getting here, nearly makes the unconscious argument that these people set up the structures necessary for their own deprivation. And thus, because they held the name America before Europeans got here and did what they did, they essentially reproduced something that was within themselves when the United States was founded and when white people moved here. And that reproduction was the deprivation of them, of their culture and their language and the land and all the rest. That's incorrect. Now, for those of you who quickly jump into your mind and say, I wasn't thinking any of that. I wasn't thinking any of that. No, you weren't. No, I absolutely understand. You were not thinking of that. What you were thinking of is the fact that this is now called America, and it's called America because your white family conquered those non-white people and put America as its name. So you should call it what you call it, or they should call it what you call it, which is America. And because they were here first, they are Native Americans. That's how you looked at it. It was a, we won this prize, we get to name it, so to hell with you. And before you tell me that's not what you were thinking, I know it's what you were thinking. Because your response to Native Indigenous people smacks of somebody who believes that they can force onto a group that is powerless to stop them from doing so a name that isn't their own. How many of you who are having a meltdown emotionally right now because you know I'm right, how many of you live in towns which clearly sound Native Indigenous, but you have no clue where that name came from? I live in central New York. We have Native Indigenous county names, town names, village names, river names, and none of the white people around here give two craps about, well, not none. There's a few. Especially those who can trace 2% of their bloodline to Native Indigenous people. But they really don't give a darn where that stuff came from. And you know how I know? Because they've told me. The great thing about having a memory, especially from the 1990s, is I remember people and what they said. They didn't want to know. They didn't care. This is America now. So who cares if there's a town called Canandaigua? Who cares? Who were the Canandaiguans? Yeah, who was Canandaigua? And who were the Canandaiguans? The Hudsons, who were they? Oh, you have no clue. Political correctness. The reason so many white folks are against it is because it takes that power dynamic away and forces a bit of equality. Not equality in the sense that, oh, we all have the same thing. No. It forces equality in the sense that we're all humans, we're all brothers and sisters, and we should be able to communicate in that way. I found it amazing, by the way, that Europeans call this thing political correctness, when in fact, it's not political, it's social. It is socially corrective. But the mere fact that Europeans, and someone's probably going to be like, well, it was a progressive or a some black person who came up with the idea of political correctness as a term. Okay, cool. Okay, cool. That doesn't change my argument. It's socially corrective. However, though, the idea of the politic in it is interesting, because what that tells me is that ultimately there is that power dynamic, and that's recognized. The power dynamic is the problem. If white folks could go about their business, learn this stuff, and not feel like they weren't as powerful as they were before, meaning, hey, look, I'm accepting this because I want to do it, not because you're telling me I should do it because you want me to respect you. White folks would adopt all this stuff overnight and not care. It's kind of like what happened in South Africa. The story of South Africa is, oh yeah, apartheid ended and everything was good. You need to see John Pilger's movie, his documentary called Apartheid Never Ended, because it's not all good. The arable land down there is still owned predominantly by white people. The diamond mines and stuff like that, the natural resources, predominantly white people. All of the things that give power and meaning to a country owned by white folks. Black people can call it whatever they want. They can act like they're in control. But the power dynamics down there have not changed. And someday I'll talk about those power dynamics, because I'm going to piss y'all off with that one. And I'm going to enjoy it. Because I'm going to talk about reparations. And y'all going to be mad when you hear my reasoning. Because it's sound. And you know how I know it's sound? Because I was told by several white people that it's sound. And it scared the F out of them. I told a brother that I knew about it. White dude, good guy, good Christian dude, you know, very humanitarian centered and focused. And I was telling him about it, and he goes, and he looks at me and he goes, I know your heart's in the right place when you talk about that. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, but man, that scares the hell out of me, man. And I'm like, why? And he's like, because you're right. I'm like, yeah, touche. Look. You know, back up a little bit, right? Political correctness need not be scary. But the power dynamic innate in it makes it scary. And I should say inherent, because it's not innate. It's inherent. It is inherited in it. Makes it scary. Another one that it took conservative white folks a lot of time to get used to is referencing, first, stop referencing black people in the United States as anything but Negro. That took a little bit of time. Or the other word, nigga, that took a lot of time. And then moving from that to African Americans. Go back to Africa, they say. Except when we say, well, then fine, call us African Americans. We don't want to call you that. Why can't we just call you American? Wait, didn't you just tell me to go back to Africa? Oh, it's something else. Anyway, that'll be it for today. Because I could keep going on. If you like the content, y'all, if you like the content, please, fund what I'm doing, help me out, fund what I'm doing, Cash App, CWB Podcast, Cash App, CWB Podcast, hit me up on PayPal, CWB Podcast there also, give me a couple of weeks. I don't know when you guys are actually going to get this. I'm recording this actually in February 19th to be exact. But I should have a email, I'm not sure if I'm going to do Gmail or what, but I will. I should have an email address. And I'm really leaning heavily towards finally doing a YouTube channel. But I don't believe I'm going to be doing it through CWB podcast. CWB podcast. I'm probably going to do it through my old podcast name, which is MT Marotti, but I'll make that announcement when it happens. So you like what I'm doing, you know, 5, 10, 20, 50, whatever you can do, it helps out a lot. Even if it's a couple bucks, I like doing this. I want to be able to do this full time. There's a couple of databases that I have my eyes on that cost some significant money to get into. So that is why I really want to hit that 3 to 6 or 6 to 10,000 level in the next 15 to 20 months, because then I'll be able to actually do that. There's a number of podcasts, both audio and video, that I would love to be throwing $100 into with you guys' help every single month. You know, my goal with that would be 20 of them. So $2,000 of what you'd give me, you know, after I meet my expenses, would go automatically to supporting these podcasts, because there's some really powerful podcasts out there that are doing amazing work. And we should be supporting them. And I would love to be the conduit to do all that. So help a brother out, y'all. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you can always reach out to me. I am your brother, Vymir Dis Ogaya. Until the next one, peace. The shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing the